Welcome to the Your Data Driven Podcast. If you like this podcast, be sure to visit our website at yourdatadriven.com for more useful help and advice on setting up your race car, mastering data analysis, and driving faster. Welcome to episode 22. Today, I'm joined by AIM guru, Matt Romanescu, with a passion for motorsports I'm sure many of us can relate to. Matt turned his hobby into his day job. Matt is one of the main AIM dealers in the whole of the United States. Often found contributing to some of the best forums on motorsports in the world, Matt is always keen to share his knowledge and help others. This is an action-packed show with lots of tips that you can use even if you're not an AIM user. So sit back, grab a coffee, and enjoy what Matt has to say. So welcome, Matt.
Thanks for being here. This is a great day.
It's so great to have you on the show. We've met virtually over the internet, you might say, but it would be great to hear about your story and how you got into what you do and your involvement in motorsport. And then just thinking about how people can get one or two takeaways, you know, maybe one or two areas that people can think, yeah, okay, I haven't really thought of that before, or I could go away and try that. Just something actionable that they can get from listening. How does that sound?
It sounds great. My background, I always think it's not too interesting, but I grew up around motorsports. My dad was in auto parts. He was in the military, then he was in auto parts right after, ran what became the largest automotive warehouse in the world, and then for some parts companies, and then some other jobs after. But he always had the passion for motorsports, and he was always really into drag racing. And growing up, we would go to the drag races, and we would go to the local Friday and Saturday night tracks a lot. And I always really enjoyed it. And I love cars and working on them. And when I turned 18, my best friend had a Porsche 914 and he said, you should come autocross it. And it's a bit of a whole nother story, but driving down to the autocross in this 914, I went from thinking it was a funny looking car that I would never want to searching the internet and anything I could every single day to try to find one.
My old housemate had a 914. Needed to rebuild in our kitchen.
My rebuilding went through a couple different garages and a basement or two. So I got a 914, originally with a 75 horsepower car. I was in college. I would work all week and go to school and then go to the racetrack on the weekend. I'd leave class Friday afternoon, drive 6 hours, 7 hours out to Watkins Glen, be on the track all weekend, and then drive home, get home late. Because you could never give up the last session. So I'd be on track till 5 o'clock. Load up, come home. Back then, it took me a month to save up my money to go do this. So I wasn't going to waste anything. The weather didn't matter. I can remember freezing on the top of at Pocono, which is up on top of a mountain. And it was October. And it should have been ice coming from the sky, but it was rain. It was one of my best sessions ever. But so I took this 914 all over. It stranded me a couple times. I had to catch rides home with people. There's some really funny stories about my little brother coming to rescue me over the years. And then when I was in college, I had a good friend and I went to pick her up at a mechanic and I walked in and he had, I think in England, it would be a Formula Ford 2000. Here they were called Formula Continentals. So like a 2 liter Pinto motor wings. And I looked at that and I went, oh man, that is a cool car. And he said, yeah, we race it. And he's not a big talker. I said, if you ever need help, I'll help. And he, all right. And then it was maybe 30 minutes from school. So then I started every day when I got out of class, I'd go up there and I started helping on it and learning Formula Fords. And back then it was a big deal. I think it was a Micron 3 Gold, an old AIM device. And this is about 2000. And we put that Micron 3 Gold in and we wired it up.
How do you do that? Okay, just to flag that. So I wonder whether there's people I talk to still question whether or not putting the instrumentation on a car is worth it. Okay. So why did you do that? So now you probably give me like a different story. But that at that time, you must have gone, yeah, there's a reason that we're going to do this. Why did you do that?
So you'll laugh is back then, and this was all over from, we were doing a lot and we were really active in the local SCCA and everybody had data, did basically one thing. They looked for over revs. That was it. It was really funny. I can remember, and this guy had an amazing Porsche 944 Turbo, just an amazing car. And I was over there and he goes, I think I over revved it. And they get his data, they download it, they look at the laptop, they find it and they go, yep, you over revved it. Delete. And that was it. All they did with the data. He goes, I think I over-revved it. They said, yes, you did. Done. So we started looking at it to pick gearing because the Formula Continental has the Hewland Mark 9 in it and you can change all your gearing. I can't say I'm in practice, but at one point I was very good at rebuilding Mark 9s and changing out gears. And so we would use it to figure out gearing. And then we started to say, how is the driver doing? And that our learning really progressed through doing all that.
So you had a kind of curiosity and you had some questions that you couldn't get a solid answer for. And you basically took this information and went, actually, that can give me a clue.
Yeah. And it really was. It was one is the question originally was, is this the best gears? Because in my area in the northeast of the U.S., we have tracks that really vary in what gears you run at average speeds and everything. So it was a really easy way to say which one's going to be better and to record what we did. And that's where it stayed for a little bit. And we started to get better about using it to improve and to have some alarms if the car was overheating. Because at that point, we were running an 86 Reynard or an 85, a weird conglomeration of a bunch of Reynard stuff. Not a particularly good car in the form we had it. So it would overheat sometimes. So we'd use it to run experiments to see if it ran cooler. So we had this idea, try to do this with the radiators, and then we'd try it and see if it made it any cooler. And that's where the data stayed for me for a while. And then it really changed when AIM came out with the original Solos. And for people that don't know what it is, it's a GPS the size of a pack of cigarettes or something, a stack of credit cards. And it gives you lap times automatically and G-forces and a couple other little measures. And when that came out, it finally brought the cost down to something that anyone could have. So we'd put this in cars and all of a sudden, if you were at a track day, your friend who was quicker, you could put it in his car and compare it to what you did and go, oh, this is where you're quicker and this is what happened. And for me, this light bulb went off. And I am the curious sort of person. So all of a sudden I could investigate these things and try to figure it out. And maybe even if the other person wasn't interested, it mounted with a magnet and I threw it in their car. And for a long time, I helped everybody at the track with them. Because if you had a question, Matt was the guy who knew the answer. And I had a really good friend through the Porsche Club. At that point, I knew him over a decade. And when he was an AIM dealer, and when somebody needed something, I'd say, you should call Jerry. He'll sell it to you and then I'll help you with it. And then finally, one day the light bulb went off and I said, hey, you're an entrepreneur and you do these things. Why are you telling someone else to buy it somewhere else? So I became an AIM dealer. And then through that curiosity and that knowledge, I've been able to help tons and tons of people doing it, all the way from the casual club driver to the lower end professionals. That's sort of my general story. For me, data was always the thing that let me answer the questions I had about why something was faster or why it worked.
So you do this full time now. This is your job.
Yeah, I have a couple businesses. And when I started this, it was a fun side thing. And really what I've done is worked myself into two full-time jobs. Luckily, with the internet and everything else today, I am able to do all my work from anywhere at any point. So from when I get up at 6 a.m. till I go to bed at 10 p.m, my phone's near me, my computer's near me, and I'm answering and helping. And no matter what business it is, I have production runs that go through the middle of the night. And sometimes I'm working on those. And sometimes it's a person in their garage that doesn't know how to configure a sensor.
Got you. So do you do any driving yourself? Is that something you spend a bit of time on track? Or?
I do. So when I was in college, I originally borrowed my friend's 914 and then I got my own. And over the years, there's a new 914 and it's a track car. And I joke that it's the rolling test bed because pretty much any sensor I can find, I will put on it for my curiosity because I love learning all these things.
Yeah, and what did you send me? You sent me some heart rate data, which is pretty cool. Looking at some tire data, like tire temp data, any data, you're like, I'll have a look at that.
I really joke the only data I don't have on it is a pitot tube because I don't know why I can't justify it yet. The car has no aero, so maybe that's really what it is. But I have brake temperatures, tire pressures, driver, all my biometrics, my heart rate and my HRV, and I can do my breathing rate in it. And then all the engine parameters. And sometimes I'll see a sensor in some other environment and I'll get it just to put on the car. So I've run a carbon monoxide sensor in the cockpit just to see what was going on. In different cars, I've run thermocouples on shocks because we were doing a lot of shock work. And if you've ever used a shock dyno, they have warm-up cycles. So when we started doing it, somebody said, oh, you run it till 100 degrees or 120 degrees. And I said, why? And they said, that's what we do. And then I said, how hot is it on the car? They said, well, we've never checked it. So I stuck a thermocouple on it and we ran thermocouples on our shocks to see what the warm-up routine should be when we go to the dyno.
Did I get to 100 degrees?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors in it. So it depends a lot on the track and how much the shock is actually working. And then it depends on the car and how they're mounted. If it's a front engine car, it's got headers really close to where the shocks are mounted, those get really hot. And depending on the airflow in the car, it can really hold a lot of heat there. Or back to a Formula Continental, we ran a Van Diemen for a while. And that has the header right next to the shock and it gets super hot. Other cars, some GT kind of tube frame cars with side exhaust, the rear shocks never get very hot unless you're on a really bumpy track where the shock's working a lot because it's not moving as much. And it has no other outside heat to heat it up. So yeah. Sometimes with data, I joke, and it's sometimes a serious answer, is it depends.
Yeah, sometimes the ignorance is bliss, isn't it? You go, oh.
I'm lucky is in helping a lot of drivers. I've worked with drivers who are very science and data driven, that you have to show them the reason. You have to show them the data that says somebody else was faster or you were faster or this works better and show them on the computer. And then I've worked with drivers who have never had any data in their life, like not even a telltale tack. And both of them can win races, but in different ways to get there. And it's really interesting because sometimes I oscillate, is that I go super data driven and I go, this is science. And then sometimes you throw it out the window and you go, it's art. And we just have to do this and see what happens. And I think the real balance is somewhere in the middle. It's a little bit of a pendulum and it swings and you get back to the middle.
So how do you deal with that? So say someone's, I don't know, they're either self-coaching or they're helping someone else out. They could be a buddy or they could be an engineer, coach or something like that. How would you approach that thing? So you've got this solo, for example, and you've got a session of data and you've got your driver there. And the goal is so that you understand what happened and then work out what to do next. How would you do that?
I am, in life in general, I'm a planner. So I look at it and I always give people, I'm like, you have a cycle and it's plan, do, review. So when I go to the track, I tell people every session you go out there, if you want to improve and you want to drive faster, you need to plan what you're doing. I've got some great friends that they go to the track more for the social. They have a great car. They enjoy it. They just want to go have fun a little bit, whether they go fast or anything. They just want to be safe. And that's a great thing. There's nothing wrong with doing that. They've never looked at data. They don't know how fast they go around. They're just having fun. But if you say, I want to be faster, I want to win, I have this goal for myself, I say, you got to make a plan. And that plan might be use the whole track. It might be carry more entry speed. It might be how you turn into a corner. You had Rob Wilson on and he makes a lot of points about how you present the car to the corner and how you tell it what to do and give it some hints of what you're going to do. So you come up with all these plans of what you want to do, and then you have to go on the track and do it. And when you go out on the track and you're doing these things and you're driving at speed, you're physically working to do it, your brain's working really hard to take in everything on the track and the flags and the cars around you, oftentimes your memory doesn't match what's really happening. So where data comes in is it's recording what really happened, whether it's video or hard data, and it's telling you this is what you really did. And then you can review it and you say, my plan was to use the whole track. Did I? And maybe you look at the video and you go, geez, there was 3 feet on corner exit. So now you've reviewed and you go, okay, what's my new strategy to use the whole track on exit? Or it's carry entry speed, whatever that plan ends up being. So I think that's where data and video really help people, is to see that they're executing the things that they want to do.
One of the things I've seen is that a transition between people going from maybe never having used data and don't really understand it to going, yeah, okay, I'll give that a go. And then once they have some understanding of what to do, which I'm going to ask you about in a minute, what your tips are, where do you start? But once you have some understanding, you very quickly, I think, go from, I don't know anything here, to I'm now completely overwhelmed. Yeah, and now I can now look at all these different elements of my lap over a 10-lap session, and I'm completely overwhelmed. And there's so much to go at. How do I then do something with that so that the next time I go out, there's already enough going on. I'm driving like pretty hard here. It's taking a lot of my attention. how do I take this knowledge that we've assimilated from my information that I did last time, and how do we make that into a plan that I can actually use? I can't go into all this detail. I've got to somehow work out the best thing to do. So have you any tips for that?
Yeah. So in the beginning of my driving journey, a really great Skip Barber driver who worked as the rabbit, he was always supposed to be the fastest guy at the track. His name's Phil Lombardi. And I talked to him and he said, driving is really easy. And I said, well, you have all these things going. He said, look, first you have to drive the line. And he said, we can get anybody to drive the line. And he said, then you have to have exit speed. And he said, if you drive the line, you hit the apex, you squeeze the gas, you accelerate down the straightaway, you got the two things. And he goes, that gets you pretty fast. And he said, the last one that's really hard and it's scary and it's where people struggle is entry speed. So when people don't know what to do and they're maybe a little, not necessarily confused, but overwhelmed by everything, I think that's a great way to go back. And my data style is I go as a driver and I say, what do I have control over? I have a steering wheel, I have a gas pedal, and I have a brake pedal. So that's what I go to. And I put those two things together and I say, I look at the video and I go, if somebody's really struggling, are you online? Are you using the whole track? Step one, if we're in the wrong spot, we're not using the full width of the track, we're just driving around the inside or the outside, or we're on the wrong side entering a corner, we're going to struggle. And that's step one. And then I say exit speed. How are you doing on the exits? And then it comes down to entry speed. And that gets to be the hard part. And then it's all the fine nuances from there on out. But the most advanced stuff is really the basics. And it comes down to, can you drive the line? Can you exit the corner? And then can we carry speed in?
Because most people are obsessed about braking and corner entry, braking. That's the people spend most of the time talking about that. But everyone has seemed to talk about everything other than that. And then that bit comes at the end, you know?
The braking. If you ask me, where's the easiest spot to help someone go fast? I'd say under braking, because it's the opposite of what we want to achieve a low lap time. I'm a really analytical person. So I go, lap time is that old equation you learned in school, distance equals rate times time, right? And you flip it around and you go, the track distance never changes. We try to go faster and get a smaller time. So I look at it, I'm like, this idea is really simple. And to do that, we can make everything faster, but that takes more horsepower and a faster car. So we can't do that. But if we can go through the corner faster, we move those parts of the lineup. And part of going through the corner faster is using less brakes. And that's really that big variable that we have control over to do things. And it's hard. That is, when you think about your driving and you think about entering a corner, like, what's everybody's biggest fear of being on track? Losing brakes. That's the thing that we're trying to go faster because we don't have brakes. And I think for a lot of people, those braking revelations come when they made a mistake. And I don't know if you're the same. I can think about, for me, it was the uphill at Lime Rock. And if people don't know Lime Rock, it's this great track in Northeast Connecticut. It's only 1.3 miles. It's a little bit of a bull ring. It's a really good lap in a street kind of car is like a minute. I think the lap record was in an old Atlantic at 42 seconds or a GTP car. And what's funny is you get to do it just over and over in a short session. And when you're driving Lime Rock, is it part of the challenge is it has all these different mixes of corners. And the uphill, you go down, they call it no name straight, and you make a right-hand turn to go up this hill. And when you get into the hill, it has all this compression. And as you do it, when you progress and you start driving there, you drive the whole way. And at some point, everybody makes a mistake and carries in too much speed. And they see the guardrail that's about 3 feet off the track and they think they're going to hit it. And the car starts sliding and you get to the hill and you get some compression and you just go shooting over the top and you go, oh, that was the most scary thing I ever did in my life. I got to get back there and do it again. Because all of a sudden you had this sort of epiphany and it clicked of what that was supposed to feel like. And I think that's sort of those kind of things are the ones that start people on their journey to figuring out what is real corner entry speed and how to feel being on that edge sometimes.
I think that's a great point. It's difficult to know sometimes what fast feels like if you've not done it. You know what I mean? It's a bit of a weird one. It's a bit counterintuitive sometimes as well, where you need to be more assertive than you are on the road, like a lot. Yeah. But then if you keep on being aggressive then and a hero, then you're not going to be so quick. So how do you make that balance, and what does that feel like? It's quite a difficult one to put into words, I think.
Yeah, it's really hard. And I think one of my takeaways over time has been from Ross Bentley. And he really tells people, he says, you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. And it doesn't always click with people until you realize that's the idea of that corner entry mistake. You're really uncomfortable because you carried maybe more speed than you thought you could. But in reality, it's really okay, but it doesn't feel right. So you're very uncomfortable, but you make it. And it wasn't dangerous and it wasn't a wreck or anything else. And then you go, oh, that didn't feel great, but it was fast and it worked really well. And then now you have to get used to doing that all the time. And as you do that, your feelings get higher and higher. And I think so many times people are amazed, and I'll say I'm amazed. I watch a video of a professional race car driver, and one that comes to mind is Lee Keen. And you see a video of him. I think the one I'm thinking of is him through a Rouge Spa in an old 911, just sideways going through it. And I go, how is he doing this? Or the old Porsche video with Yellowbird at the Nürburgring. And it's
that's
sideways.
That's the rough one that just goes sideways everywhere.
Yeah. For that, you go, oh my goodness, how could anyone do this the whole way? And you go, they're comfortable being uncomfortable. Like, he probably doesn't feel that he's got it all under control, just perfect, and everything's wonderful, but he still knows he has it.
Yeah. Your point is good, because that's why skid pans and these sort of formal environments with low friction surfaces exist, so that you can get the feeling for what going past the limit feels like, such that you think, okay, now I can get some confidence. I think one of the other things that Ross says, which is great, and it's been repeated by a number of coaches I've talked to, is that whilst you, no one can see this, but you're down here and you want to be up there, and going there in one big jump isn't the way to do it. That is quite scary. If you can do it in little steps and work your way up, so you're uncomfortable, but only marginally. Yeah, yeah. You're not terrible. Yeah, so it's just okay. And then you get a bit of confidence in that, and then you push it a little bit more, push it a little bit more. So you're doing it much more in a controlled way, I think.
Yeah, I tell people, I don't want them to be uncomfortable, and I don't want them to go into a corner at 110%. I want them to go in at 100.5,
yeah, exactly.
Just a tiny bit.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
They don't really like it. And it's almost like I made a mistake, but you can do it okay. And it wasn't really an event. You didn't get back and you didn't take off your helmet and wipe your forehead and tell your friend, oh man, it almost all went bad. It was, I should have hit the brake a millisecond longer or harder, but I made it. And then you go, it didn't feel, it was more than I thought I should do, but I was still online and I still hit the apex and I still was able to pick up the throttle. And then you went, maybe my feeling's wrong. And that's how you can do it. So you're right. You don't go from, if you're 5 seconds down on whatever your goal is or something like that, or the other competitors you're racing with, you don't go for 5 seconds. You go for a tiny bit. And I think for me, all the learning is part of the fun. I think sometimes we get caught up in this end goal, but the journey of it is really great. And I know I'm guilty of this all the time, that you feel like you hit a plateau, whether it's your own driving or you're instructing or you're coaching or you're working in things, and you get frustrated. But sometimes you have to take a step back and look at it and say, wait a minute, I did make improvements and I did do this better. Or maybe you don't do it better, but you do it consistently better, the same. You only went up half a step, but you're always there.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think those are the things. It's like the journey of driving is part of the fun.
I agree with you. And when we're like having this conversation here, that's the mindset. But then I still can't help being disappointed if I don't go out. And yeah, it's one of those things. It's, yeah, that all makes sense. But then like in the heat of the moment, you know, I'm still a bit down, actually. I think I could have done better. It's just like you can't help yourself. But you have to, I think at least having the awareness of that perspective is really healthy, because the learning is part of the game and it is hard and it wouldn't be as fun otherwise if you did it. And then there are people who can come along and they're not analytical at all and they just get in the car and they seem to drive around and they're quicker than you. It's okay, they have more talent or whatever. One of the things that data though has helped me with personally is able to dissect some of that mystery. It's like someone gets in a car and they're maybe 1 second quicker than you or 1.5 seconds quicker than you. And when you're just looking at lap time, that still feels like a golf. That feels like a lot of time. Say, I know, right, over one and a half minute lap or something.
Yeah.
But when you start to get into the data side of things, it could be that they are just doing something ever so slightly different in three corners that gives them three tenths of a second in three little spots. And the rest of the lap is completely the same as what you're doing.
One of the things, I shouldn't give away my secret, but it's one of the things I really love to do with data. So if I'm working with a club, and up here now is we have a lot of membership kind of club tracks, and I'll go and I'll help a group of people that are all members. So they show up for the day, they want to go drive, and we'll put a solo still in their car. And we bring it in and I grab everybody's data and I put it up and everybody gathers around and I say, oh, geez, Tom, you did this and Jim, you were doing this. And I find it's a conversation starter. So exactly like you said, is everybody goes, he goes, yeah, you were a little bit faster here. And then they start talking and he describes what he did. I did this and I did this. And then the other person goes, I was doing this. And he goes, huh, I think maybe I should try that. And then this conversation starts and I just back out because now they're having their own experience. It's not me telling somebody what to do, but they're asking each other questions and formulating it in their mind how they think, because everybody has to process a little bit different. And it gets them going on their own journey, not what I have prescribed.
So it's interesting. So data is often perceived or maybe even promoted as the ability to get the answer to your question. Mm-hmm. But in fact, what you're saying there is a little bit more subtle than that. Is it will give you the answer to the places where you need to look, and then you need to work it out yourself. But at least you're looking in the right place.
Right. So a lot of times with data, Roger at AIM loves to say it's what happened, where it happened, why it happened. So a lot of times we can find the what and the where, and he refers to it as the triangle, but the why becomes harder. And depending on what sensors we have, we can say why easier or not. But if we just have a speed trace and we take three drivers, we can see the speed was different. We can see where. And then if you start a dialogue and everybody starts explaining things, you can see the why. And I think a lot of times is the science of driving says what the car did and the physics. The why part is what are those little inputs and how does it feel? So I think a lot of times the data is just a great discussion starter of what did you do and why did you do that? And over the years, it's been interesting. I worked with one driver and it was a team. And the one driver, all I had to do was say somebody was faster in a corner. I said, turn one, this person's faster than you. And they went, huh. And then let me see. And they'd look at the chart and they'd see someone is faster. And then he would go out and be faster in turn one. And if you said, how did you do it? We still joke about it. He would look and he'd go, oh, I was coming in and I braked. And then I just thought, what can I do to get on throttle sooner? He goes, and then I did it. And that was his analysis, the whole thing. And you said, well, what did you do that? He goes, oh, I did it. I hit the throttle. And then other people you get down to and you get these minute details of there's a shiny silver part of the asphalt. And when I get there, I do this. And when I do this, I see this. And sometimes you compare notes with the driver. And I've had drivers say there was a paint dot on the asphalt. And it's a track I had thousands of laps in 1 year. And I couldn't find it. They claimed it was turn three. There was a green dot on the pavement. I could never, ever find it. So it's interesting, all these different things people take in. But I think the more discussion you have and the more you look at it, the more your world opens as you drive and the more input you have to make all those references and things.
So one of the things I always talk to people about, particularly people who are a little bit like, oh, data, it's geeky. And there's also the fun element comes in there, right? So if you're going racing and you want to have fun and you find this stuff unfun, then you're not going to want to do it. Right? So you may look for reasons to not do it, and it doesn't give you a complete answer and it doesn't give you a complete picture. So it's quite an easy target in some ways to poo-poo the whole thing. And the other point that is often made is, what's the point of showing me my qualifying data? Because qualifying is done and I can't go back and do anything about it. And that's a kind of a nice point in one sense, but what I want to lead on to a question about preparation and what would you recommend in terms of drivers, how would they prepare to go out on the track?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific question. And what I always tell people is a plan. And the drivers I work with, a lot of times I'll give them a book. And in that book, I have something for them to do every session.
Or you have a process, a coaching process that you, or
it varies so much, because sometimes somebody wants just an idea, and then some people will come to you and say, I want to do this coaching, and I want to do these things. Then when you go to do it, they don't really want to put the effort in. It's more they want one nugget of information, and then some people just are sponges and they just want you to keep delivering to them like a fire hose, and they want to soak it all up.
It's interesting. I've done the same though. You're in this kind of tension though. You've got like the one person who doesn't want the information could do with a little bit more, and the person who wants this sponge of information could just do with. You have to like, don't worry about all of that. Just like have a little bit less, you know.
And I think as the coach and as the whether you're really coaching them or instructing them, because I think those are different roles, is that's part of your job is to figure out, do they need a fire hose or do they need one thing? And you steer them away from the others. But I like to tell people, I'm like, use every moment we have to be productive. I've worked in series where I think we had one weekend that it was, when you added all the costs up for the weekend, it was $10,000 an hour to be on track. And then I've done other things where maybe it's $10 an hour to be on track. So I say to people, either way, the track time is limited, right? So use your track time as productive as you can. So if it's a brand new student, they've never been to the track before, I tell them on your warm up and your cool down lap, wave to the flaggers. Use that as a chance, pick out every single flag station, wave to the flagger, because you're ingraining where those people are. And then as people improve, I call them skill builders. And I say every out lap and every in lap, I want you to do some skill builders. And sometimes those things extend to half the session. And then I just want you to go turn everything off that we talked about and just go drive and do things. And sometimes that's use the whole track. Sometimes it's things like how you're looking through the track. Sometimes it might be something, if a driver has trouble really committing to throttle, say, I don't want you to go really fast. I want you to drive 3/4 speed. But when you pick up that apex, I want you to squeeze until you're all the way to the throttle. So it varies for each person, but I have this big list of ideas and topics to feed from. And then individualize the people and see what they need.
How do you approach coaching? Is that something that people come to you with? Just to give some context to that question, my background quite recently has been in the world of Olympic sports and professional sports, mm-hmm. where coaching is a kind of a non-question. It's like, in fact, we don't have one coach. We have a head coach and we have sub-coaches for different parts of the game. Coaching is a thing, and they've been dealing with a human being for a long time. They know the impact that coaching can have and psychology can have and performance planning can have on that outcome. And it's just a, how good can we be? In motorsports, it's still a question mark. And it's, do I need a coach? Is that really for me? So how do you put that question to people? It's a bit like with the data. Do I really need this? I'm already spending a lot of money here. Do I need a coach? What value am I going to get from a coach?
So I'd say, and my favorite answer, it depends. So I think at the high levels, the coaching question is basically gone. If the races we watch on TV, that the highest level drivers of all the different classes, I think the idea of a coach is gone. And we see that through F1. We see that through DTM and IMSA and all those places. Like, the idea that there's not a coach is gone. And I think in some of those, the coach takes a little bit maybe of a different role. And that sometimes it's a teammate and the two of them are working together, and it's a different relationship than a coach that travels with someone. And I think even down to the club level, that what I see, and I was talking to someone this morning about the same thing, is that in the beginning levels, certainly in the US, the best organizations have instructors and coaches that help guide people through. And maybe the coach isn't one person, maybe it's the coach is more an organization, but they have classroom training, they have group leaders, they have instructors in the car with a cohesive message. And I think the coaching isn't that singular idea that we're discussing, that it's a person, but it's the group. And certainly in the Olympic level, that where you have organizations, whether it's the general ski team or a bobsled team, where all these different coaches together coach their little parts, but as a whole, the athlete comes out better. And I think we see that with a lot of really good groups now.
So the definition of coaching is an interesting one, because I don't think it's a word that people would think they would struggle to define, but who has the same definition of coach, right? I mean, how would you define a coach? Is there a difference between a coach and instructor?
I think so. I think back to when I was in school, and you say, when you're in the elementary, the lowest levels, you're a 6-year-old kid, you're a 7-year-old kid, you go to school, what's your teacher doing? They're really an instructor. They're relaying what information kind of one way, and they are telling you facts and things. And then I think back to the best professors I had in college, and how did they teach me? And they asked me questions and they made me think. They didn't tell me a lot. And they guided your journey, but from half a step behind you. And I think that's the role of the coach, is the coach isn't there to tell you break later, do this. It's to help you figure out, can you break later and how?
Yeah, I agree. So initially you need more instruction because you don't know what you don't know. Later on, where you have an idea, I don't know when this later on is, right?
Right.
But you have an idea of what you're trying to do. And then it's a case of maybe having someone who can check and challenge what you're doing, but their success is aligned with your success, if you see what I mean. They want you to do well. They're in your camp.
Yeah. But I think later on is for every level is just a little bit more. Because if you're an instructor, so I do a lot with some different car clubs, and you get someone who comes out to the track for the very first day, and you go over the flag stations and a turn in and an apex and a track out. The next day they come back and they went, oh, I get the turn in. That's where I go from straight till I start to go into the corner. Or maybe they start seeing things. Now you're later on, right? You're still an instructor, but you hit that later on. So now the journey's not really linear in all their information. There's some things that you're instructing for maybe years, and there's other things that you're coaching from the second day. That's my take, is I think my role as a coach or an instructor or a helper in people learning completely varies on what the person needs.
Yeah, it's great to hear that, actually, because I really agree with that model myself, that this kind of, it's an evolving model that depends on the individual and who you're dealing with. And their space. Yeah. And even as a coach, like one of the things that I also see in racing is this, and I don't know why it is, and I don't know if there's a polite way of putting it, but it's an arrogance of, or a frustration, or a kind of, we're looking down on you because you're new and you don't know what you're doing and you can't drive as quick as I can. And you're like, why people? But maybe because it's competitive. You're like, it's just competitive sport underneath, and we all want to do better, and I want to be the big top dog. And I don't know what it is, right? But there's something underlying there that means that the attitude sometimes can be a little bit patronizing.
Yeah, I think sometimes, though, it's lack of confidence.
Yeah.
So I mentioned Phil before, and I watched Phil put a car on pole at a race. And the guy on outside pole came over and said, how did you do that lap? And he goes, oh, you know, what part? The guy goes, I can never get through turn whatever. Yep. And in excruciating detail, Phil told him everything to do to beat him. The guy, his main competitor, told him exactly what to do, what Phil does. And I went over to him after. I said, why did you do that? He goes, I don't think he can. And if he does, I need to be better.
Yeah.
And it changed how I thought about it. I said, geez, how cool is that? And that's why I share my data all over. Because I say, I'm not perfect. I don't claim. I'm a 40-something-year-old guy. Nobody's looking at me to become the next race driver somewhere, but I'm having a ton of fun. And I can share my journey, and maybe that helps other people, and maybe that shows them some things that they can do. And I'm comfortable knowing I'm not perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. It is confidence, though, isn't it? It's having that confidence to share. Because the other thing about motorsports is it's quite secretive. I've had this idea for something to tweak on the car and I'm not going to tell anyone about it. And
right.
Within the rules, obviously. And sometimes it even is. Yeah. And you think, right, okay, so there's two parts to it. There's the sport of preparation, and then mm-hmm. there's the sport of driving, and also telling people how to work it out for themselves. I think there's sort of safety in that, because at the end of the day, you can be the fastest person in the paddock, but you get people on track. And more than one time, I've been like, oh, this guy's really good. You get out on track and they're like, what are they doing? And they're like, I'm great. I'm just like, I'm right. I'm going to follow this person. They really know what they're doing. And they don't. And they're like, I thought you said you were flat through that corner. There was no way you were flat through that.
Right. The famous flat. I'm flat there. And you're like, the data doesn't say you were. A funny story about being flat. We were at a track at Miami Homestead. And I said to the driver, I said, you got to be flat through the oval. Like that's what you got to do through there. and the car's fast and it's steep. And they said, I am. And I looked, I said, you're not. Like, we looked at the data and he goes, oh, geez. And it wasn't a big lift, but a little one. And he went about the next session. He came in and I looked and I said, you got to be flat. And he goes, I was flat. And he's a strong guy. And he goes, I had 2 feet on that accelerator. I was flat. And we figured out the car was twisting. Like, however, the car twisted a little bit and it was like coming off 3% on the throttle. Yeah, the flat story always amuses me because sometimes people claim flat and then you look at the data and you're like, you were at 20%. You know, you're still super fast, but you're at 20%.
Yeah, it does. It just challenges you, doesn't it? Yeah, we can do all this stuff and we can be like in the paddock and saying, you need to do that. But then you get out there and you're in a high speed corner and it's not quite, the engine's not as nice as you want it to be, or you haven't got the vision you want, or haven't got a model in your head of exactly what you're going to do. And it's a bit of a journey into the unknown every time. And it's a brave sport. You have to do it. If you're going to be quick, you just have to. And I certainly can't always do it.
But I think some of it goes back to the idea of fun. And listening when you were talking with Jeff Brown, is one of his comments was he realized he was working on the car and he was bummed out that he had to go drive it. Because he realized his version of fun was engineering and building this car. And I have friends like that. I have a friend who's a master fabricator. In 20 years, his car's been together for one event because he enjoys building.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we all have friends like that, right? Some friends love to drive and they take their car. They do a ride and drive. They pay someone to bring the car because their enjoyment is just the driving. They want to put a helmet on, jump in and go. Other people have to buy a new race suit because they got it all greasy because they love working on it. So I think it really depends. Is you have to figure out what's fun for you to go away from it. And whether it's the data portion, I know some folks that show up and it's people that win races at high levels and they just want to drive. They don't look at the data. They don't do anything. They want to go out and have fun. And you got to figure out what your fun is.
I think that's exactly right. And it's what Jeff also said, which is a really lovely phrase. It's being introduced to a professional approach. So he's providing a professional approach. But what's nice is that you get the choice. Yeah. So by understanding and learning and talking to people like yourself and Jeff, and you at least know what the professional approach is, such that if you choose to do it, you've got the option. It's better to know and then choose not to do it because you think that's dull fun rather than just to be in the dark completely. It goes with sponsorship, all that sort of stuff. There's so much information out there and people I've talked to as well who've literally given you like checklist, like this is how to go and get someone else to pay for your racing. This is how you do it. This is what they want. This is how you do it. That's it. But at the same time, it's nothing's for nothing. So you've got to put the effort in and that's not fun.
And I think just like you said earlier, was sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Yeah. And that's where a guy like Jeff or what you do, what I do, can bring some, I hesitate to say formality, but process to what people do. So instead of being haphazard of they show up at the track late, they don't know what everything on, it's like maybe for that person, your version of coaching is to make sure they printed out a schedule and they have a watch. And that makes such a difference to them because now they're not realizing their group's going out on track and they're trying to put their helmet on and they're 10 minutes late all the time. So maybe it's just they need to be on time to get on track. Maybe other folks, it's the checklist of how many times have you been at the track and somebody runs out of gas because they had so much fun, they never thought to check it. So maybe they need the checklist. It says, did you check your tire pressures? Did you check your lug nuts? Did you check the fuel? And I think that's that sort of process that at some levels and on some teams, it's not even thought about. It's just what you do. But to the beginner, it's something they never thought about. But the idea, I don't know if it's the same in the UK. In the US, there's a lot of track days and so many people don't know. They show up at the track, they don't know where to park. They don't know to empty their car. They don't know to go through inspection. All these little things that they just don't know yet. And sometimes as you're coaching or instructing, your guide is to just help someone through the process.
Well, one of the issues, if there is with motorsports, I'll say the nice issue first in the sense that once it's in your blood, it's stuck. You can't get rid of it. So that's a nice issue. But then the other one is there is this kind of hurdle to entry and it is all this faff and all this complexity and all this, and it's intimidating for people. And so I can understand why people would want to do the ride and drive. And so they can just, it's a bit like going to, I don't know, I'm sure you have the same corporate karting kind of thing where you just like, you put a boiler suit over your own clothes, you borrow a helmet, you drive around in the go-kart, everyone yep. has, and they want that similar kind of accessibility on the track, is a notch up. And so there's so much stuff that you get overwhelmed. And yeah, maybe if they have some exposure to at least some of these basics, like taking the stuff out of the car. I never thought of that one before. I've never track dayed a car that I would drive on the road, actually. But it's like, yeah, that's a really good idea.
Right. When I started, I didn't have a trailer. So I drove my car to the track. So if I wanted to bring another set of tires, you can imagine a 914, I could fit four tires and a cooler and a jack and my clothes for a weekend. Yeah. And then I'd have to take the car down into town to get gas and come back and do these things. And that's all the stuff that when you don't know, you don't know. I was lucky. I had a friend whose parents were into this and they were able to guide me. But I try to help people with that. And that's part of the reason when we first met, you had asked for data or you asked a question and I said, hey, I'll send him my data. This guy wants to get into this. It's my way to pay things back to help people in. And that's my approach because it's not a secret club. It's not, I want to make it accessible to everybody. So if somebody's enjoyment is being a fan and looking at it and seeing some race car data because they think it's amazing, I'll give it to them. And if it's a little kid that's walking by our transporter and he's in awe of the car, I tell him to hold on and I grab a Sharpie and I get a card and I run to the driver and I have him sign a thing to give the kid because maybe that's the thing that lights a spark in that kid. The craziness that's come out of this last year, I think one of the good things is it has started all these people sim racing. And I work with AIM a lot. And when all this happened, they changed directions for a little bit and put a lot of effort and time to make ways that you could get all that sim data and bring it into their software and use Race Studio 3 and 2 to analyze your data next to your car data. And I think that's a big moment that the sim world has been great, but it's been maybe not as well known, is coming out. And now I'm not a big gamer. I know there's all the software. You can watch people play games and you can talk to them and all these things. I think that's building the community there and bringing it out. And hopefully some of those people love the sim. And then through a lot of these entry-level racing series that are becoming really competitive and really great series on their own, gives people a chance to get into that. I know one of the ones I want to come over to the UK, and I really want to drive two cars. You'll have to help me. One is I want to drive the Beatles, the Kafer Cup. I want to race one of those. And what is it, a CV3?
The Citroën.
Yes. I really want to drive one because I go, this is so different than anything I've worked with. I want that new challenge. And it looks like amazing racing.
There's a C2 championship as well, which is like the newer version with that, where we had a race. It was a couple of years ago at Silverstone and there were 100 cars on the grid.
Yeah. And how great those cars are, really low horsepower, right?
Yeah. And not all of them finished and it rained. And actually my friends won the race and they won it on the last lap in a 24-hour race. And the people who were leading were really low on fuel. And so if they come in, they would have lost their place. So they were driving really slow. And they crossed the finish line with 3 seconds to go before the 24-hour had expired. So then they were first. And then they had to do a whole other lap with my friends chasing them up from behind. And my friends overtook them on the last corner. And so they coasted over the line second. And if they'd just been a bit slower, yeah, it's a great race.
Hear that story. And I think how amazing is this that I go, if I went and did that race, think of the strategy decisions you have to make. So obviously if they're not very fast, they're sipping fuel, but you have to make these fuel strategies and maintenance and driver changes and all that. So I go, that's just so cool to learn all that in that environment.
The thing is the cars get trashed.
Yeah.
But then normally that's the end of the weekend. In this race, it's we'll just get it back to the pits and we'll fix it and get it back out.
So you have to learn this new car that's not really a race car. So you have to learn how to race this thing. And then you have the additional challenge of, yeah, it broke. So maybe you're nursing it along. Maybe it's got the brakes are worn out. The tires are worn out. The suspension's all sloppy. A spring gave up and you're trying to coax this thing through it. And the team that lost you, like they did everything right. And they were 3 seconds wrong.
You just had to slow down and stop. Like, and wait for those 3 seconds to tick over and then cross the line, and you would have won.
Yeah. He was like a third of a second wrong in every corner of the prior lap.
I'm aware of the time for you. I know you need to get off. Leave us with one or two takeaways. Come on. What's going to help people other than driving these kind of crazy cars? What two or three things you see all the time that people are doing and you think, I wish they didn't do that? Or, you know, if only they did this slightly differently, that would really help them. So what would you say for those?
Oh, boy. So if I had three, I think I would say always have a plan. Don't go out to just pound around laps, but say, I have a plan. I'm going to use the whole track. I am going to accelerate better. I'm going to carry entry speed. I'm going to have more references, whatever those things are. Have a plan when you get in the car of what you're going to do. And then do I have to give three or can I give two?
Just one or two is fine.
Yeah. All right. So I'd say the second one, and it's an involved one, is question why. The name of your podcast, you're data driven. That's me. So when somebody says, run this tire pressure, why? And if you have data, use it. I've been putting out tips on my Instagram and in social media. One of them was, you always have data. If you have a stopwatch, if you have a tire pressure gauge, if you have sector times, whatever you have, use it. If you have nothing, keep a notebook with what the weather was. All these little things are, it is data. And use it to answer why. So when someone tells you, we all have these track stories or this kind of tribal knowledge and say, why? Like someone tells you, oh, your car is light. You should only run 30 PSI of pressure. Or your car is heavy, run 38. Why? And then try it. Do something different. It's one of the ones I actually learned from Jeff. And he did a podcast one time and he said, don't make a little change. Don't change a pound. Go three, go four. See what happens. And I know you've experienced that in your engineering as well, is make a change that's going to do something and ask why and start honing in on things. Maybe it's tire pressures. Maybe it's just driving. Try a different line in a corner. Try something different. Because if we go out and you always do the same exact thing, you'll always get the same result. So yeah. Question why and try something. So maybe that was three. Have a plan. Ask why. Try something new.
Yeah. There you go. Boom. It wasn't that hard.
We could keep going on forever. I think that's why I want to come over and drive a 2CV, right? Yep. Something totally, we don't have those in the US. We don't have anything even. It'd be so neat to do something new.
Yeah. And that's the lovely thing. There are so many options in motorsport, aren't there? Try new things.
And it makes me think maybe I have to get you to get the 2CV and I'll bring over the data system. We can have the most data laden 2CV ever.
In history. Yeah. You might not win that data, actually. It's like... Brilliant. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. I knew it would be. I knew it would be really good fun. And thank you for taking the time. And it's just fascinating to hear your story. Thanks.
Oh, thanks for having me. I could talk motorsports forever. And it's a passion, right? It's what you love. It's what I love. It's what the listeners love. It's so easy to talk about the things and that the trails can take so far. I've made some of my best friends doing this and had my best conversations. And so often the motorsports becomes like a microcosm of life, right? Lifelong learning and coaching and all these things. I have kids and it all transfers along. It was wonderful. I had a real great time.
How fantastic to have Matt on the show. Such an enthusiast for the sport, and I can't wait to welcome him to the UK if he does actually manage to come over for a race in the 2 Series. I hope you got plenty of takeaways from our conversation, not only around understanding the data, but how you can apply it. You may know that at the end of season one, I wrote the Motorsports Playbook, a summary distilling the first 20 shows into nuggets of wisdom. I made the notes so that you don't have to. If you've not got it yet, go and grab yourself a copy from the website. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and visit us at yourdatadriven.com.